This is Ingrid Christiansen. I'm going to be doing reading a short story, and we'll have a discussion about it. Today, the short story is called The Day I Sat with Jesus, and it has a subtitle, which is a continuation of The Day I Sat with Jesus, which is kind of weird. On the sun deck, and a wind came up and blew my kimono open, and he saw my breasts. That's the title of the story. It's by Gloria Sawai. Gloria is Lutheran Scandinavian Canadian woman who is married to a Japanese man. They have several children. This story is, I think, the single most anthologized short story in contemporary Canadian fiction. So it's well known in Canada, but like much of the Canadian literature that is current there, we don't know about it in the States. So I've been sort of discovering Canadian literature lately and really enjoying it. And Gloria Sawai is a wonderful woman. She's complex and interesting, but very refreshing and fun. I actually met her a couple of weeks ago because I was in Edmonton and enjoyed her very much. So I'm going to read the story, and then we'll talk about it. It's a sort of a long story. I may decide to leave out a little bit of it as we get toward the end. But the story is framed, and I'm going to kind of indicate to you when I finished reading the frame and when the narrative begins, because I think it might help you to understand what she's saying. I think it's harder maybe to hear a story than to see it written for some people. So I'll give you a little bit of a stuff about it as we're going through the frame, and then I'll just read it straight through and we can talk about it. The majority of the frame is at the front. There's just a little bit of framing at the end to kind of close it down. The story is interesting in one dynamic that I want to point out to you before I start reading, and that is that, as the title says, the day I sat with Jesus on the sun deck and a wind came up and blew my kimono open and he saw my breasts, it's extraordinary in the subject, in what happens in the story. It's extraordinary. It's hard to say it any other way. And yet what Gloria has done, what the author has done, the narrator has done, is to, every time something extraordinary happens in the story, to contrast it with a very ordinary parallel in her own life. So that it's almost annoying at first when you read it, because there's this extraordinary thing happening, namely Jesus comes and sits on her deck, and what happens. And real regularly throughout, there'll be a paragraph about some parallel thing in her own life that happens. And so you kind of watch for that, and you realize that the things out of her own life shed light on what's going on the deck with Jesus, and the things on the deck with Jesus reflect into her own life. So that's a kind of to help you get a handle on listening to it, I just want to point that dynamic out. It's also like a poem. I always like to, but there's never time, but I always like to read you a poem that sort of sheds light on the story too. If there's time at the end, I'll do that. If not, I won't. So what she does in the beginning, in the frame, I think setting the stage for us to understand the story is to tell us a lot about herself. And the kinds of information she gives us about herself, I think, are things to let us identify with her, to let us recognize her as a fellow human traveler, to let us recognize things in her that we are and that we can relate to. I'll begin. When an extraordinary event takes place in your life, you're apt to remember with unnatural clarity the details surrounding it. You remember shapes and sounds that weren't directly related to the occurrence, but hovered there in the periphery of the experience. This can even happen when you read a great book for the first time, one that unsettles you and startles you into thought. You remember where you read it, what room, who was nearby. I can remember, for instance, when I read Of Human Bondage. I was lying on a top bunk in our high school dormitory, wrapped in a blue bedspread. I lived in a dormitory then because of my father. He was a religious man who wanted me to get a spiritual kind of education, to hear the Word and know the Lord, as he put it. So he sent me to St. John's Lutheran Academy in Regina for 2 years. He was confident, I guess, that that's where I'd hear the Word. Anyway, I can still hear Mrs. Sverdrin, our house mother, knocking on the door at midnight and whispering in her Norwegian accent, "Now, Gloria, it is 12 o'clock. Time to turn off the lights right now." Then scuffling down the corridor in her bedroom slippers. What's interesting here is that I don't remember anything about the book itself, except that someone in it had a club foot. But it must have moved me deeply when I was 16, which is some time ago now. You can imagine then how distinctly I remember the day Jesus of Nazareth, in person, climbed the hill in our backyard to our house, and then up the outside stairs to the sun deck where I was sitting, and how he stayed with me for a while. You can surely understand how clear those details rest in my memory. The event occurred on Monday morning, 11 September 1972, in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan. These facts in themselves are more unusual than they may appear at first glance. September is my favorite month. Monday, my favorite day. Morning, my favorite time. And although Moose Jaw may not be the most magnificent place in the world, even so, if you happen to be there on a Monday morning in September, it has its beauty. It's not hard to figure out why these are my favorites, by the way. I have 5 children and a husband. Things get hectic, especially on weekends and holidays. Kids hanging around the house, eating, arguing, asking me every hour what there is to do in Moose Jaw. And television. Programs are always the same, only the names change. Rough Riders, Stampeders, Blue Bombers, whatever. So when school starts in September, I bask in freedom, especially on Monday. No quarrels, no TV, the morning crisp and lovely, a new day, a fresh start. On the Monday of 11 September, I got up at 7, the usual time, cooked cream of wheat for the kids, fried a bit of sausage for Fred, waved them all out of the house, drank a second cup of coffee in peace, and decided to get at last week's ironing. I wasn't dressed yet, but still in the pink kimono I'd bought years ago on my trip to Japan, my one and only overseas trip, a $300 quick tour of Tokyo and other cities. I'd saved for this while working as a library technician in Regina, and I'm glad I did. Since then, I've hardly been out of Saskatchewan. Once in a while, a trip to Winnipeg, a few times down to Medicine Lake, Montana, to visit my sister. I set up the ironing board and hauled out the basket of week-old sprinkled clothes. When I unrolled the first shirt, it was completely dry and smelled stale. The second was covered with little gray blots of mold. So was the third. Fred teaches junior high science here in Moose Jaw. He uses a lot of shirts. I decided I'd have to unwrap the whole basket full and air everything out. This I did, spreading the pungent garments about the living room. While they were airing, I would go outside and sit on the deck for a while, since it was a clear and sunny day. If you know Moose Jaw at all, you'll know about the new subdivision at the southeast end called Hillhurst. That's where we live, right on the edge of the city. In fact, our deck looks out on flat land as far as the eye can see, except for the backyard itself, which is a fairly steep hill leading down to a stone quarry. But from the quarry, the land straightens out into the Saskatchewan prairie. One clump of poplars stands beyond the quarry to the right, and high weeds have grown up among the rocks. Other than that, it's plain, just earth and sky. But when the sun rises new in the morning, weeds and rocks take on an orange and rusty glow that is pleasing, to me at least. I unplugged the iron and returned to the kitchen. I'd take a cup of coffee out there, or maybe some orange juice. To reach the juice at the back of the fridge, my hand passed right next to a bottle of red dry Kelowna. Now here was a better idea. A little wine on Monday morning, a little relaxation after a rowdy weekend. I held the familiar bottle comfortably in my hand and poured, anticipating a pleasant day. I slid open the glass door leading to the deck. I pulled an old canvas folding chair into the sun and sat and sipped. Beauty and tranquility floated toward me on Monday morning, 11 September, around 9:40. So there you have the stage. She's basically okay, except for the wine, which was a little vaguely disorganized, but nice, and you recognize her. First, he was a little bump on the far, far off prairie. Then he was a mole way beyond the quarry. Then a larger animal, a dog perhaps, moving out there through the grass. Nearing the quarry, he became a person, no doubt about that. A woman, perhaps, still in her bathrobe. But edging out from the rocks, through the weeds, toward the hill, he was clear to me. I knew then who he was. I knew it just as I knew the sun was shining. The reason I knew is that he looked exactly the way I'd seen him 5,000 times in pictures, in books, in Sunday school pamphlets. If there was ever a person I'd seen and heard about over and over, this was the one. Even in grade school, those terrible questions. Do you love the Lord? Are you saved by grace alone through faith? Are you awaiting eagerly the glorious day of his second coming? And will you be ready on that great day? I'd sometimes hidden under the bed when I was a child, wondering if I really had been saved by grace alone, or without realizing I'd been trying some other method, like the Catholics, who were saved by their good works and would all land in hell. Except for a few who knew in their hearts it was really grace, but they didn't want to leave the church because of their relatives. And was this it? Would the trumpet sound tonight and the sky split in two? Would the great Lord and King, Alpha and Omega, holding aloft the seven candlesticks, accompanied by a heavenly host that no man could number, descend from heaven with a mighty shout? And was I ready? Reverend Hansen in his high pulpit in Swift Current, Saskatchewan, roared in my ears and clashed against my eardrums. And there he was, coming, climbing the hill in our backyard, his body bent against the climb, his robes ruffling in the wind. He was coming, and I was not ready. All those moldy clothes scattered about the living room, and me in this faded old thing made in Japan and drinking in the middle of the morning. He had reached the steps now. His hands touched the railing. His right hand was on my railing. Jesus' fingers were curled around my railing. He was coming up. He was ascending. He was coming up to me here on the sun deck. He stood on the top step and looked at me. I looked at him. He looked exactly right, exactly the same as all the pictures. White robe, purple stole, bronze hair, creamy skin. How had all those queer artists, illustrators of Sunday school papers, how had they gotten him exactly right like that? He stood at the top of the stairs. I sat there holding my glass. What do you say to Jesus when he comes? How do you address him? Do you call him Jesus? I suppose that was his first name. Or Christ. I remember the woman at the well, the one living in adultery, who'd called him Sir. Perhaps I could try that. Or maybe I should pretend not to recognize him. Maybe, for some reason, he didn't mean for me to recognize him. Then he spoke. Good morning, he said. My name is Jesus. How do you do, I said. My name is Gloria Johnson. My name is Gloria Johnson. That's what I said, all right, as if he didn't know. He smiled, standing there at the top of the stairs. I thought of what I should do next. Then I got up and unfolded another canvas chair. You have a nice view here, he said, leaning back against the canvas and pressing his sandaled feet against the iron bars of the railing. Thank you, I said. We like it. Nice view. Those were his very words. Everyone who comes to our house and stands on the deck says that. Everyone. I wasn't expecting company today. I straightened the folds of my pink kimono and tightened the cloth more securely over my knees. I picked up the glass from the floor where I'd laid it. I was passing through on my way to Winnipeg. I thought I'd drop by. I've heard a lot about you, I said. You look quite a bit like your pictures. I raised the glass to my mouth and saw that his hands were empty. I should offer him something to drink. Tea? Milk? How should I ask him what he'd like to drink? What words should I use? It gets pretty dusty out here, I finally said. Would you care for something to drink? He looked at the glass in my hand. I could make you some tea, I added. Thanks, he said. What are you drinking? Well, on Mondays, I like to relax a bit after the busy weekend with the family all home. I have 5 children, you know, so sometimes after breakfast, I have a little wine. That would be fine, he said. By luck, I found a clean tumbler in the cupboard. I stood by the sink pouring the wine, and then, like a bolt of lightning, I realized my situation. Oh, Johann Sebastian Bach, glory, honor, wisdom, power, George Friedrich Handel, King of Kings and Lord of Lords, he's on my sun deck. Today, he's sitting on my sun deck. I can ask him any question under the sun, anything at all, and he'll know the answer. Hallelujah, hallelujah. Well, now, wasn't this something for a Monday morning in Moose Jaw? I opened the fridge door to replace the bottle, and I saw my father. It was New Year's morning. My father was sitting at the kitchen table. My mother sat across from him. She'd covered the oatmeal pot to let it simmer on the stove. I could hear the lid bumping against the rim quietly. Sigrid and Frida sat on the other side of the table, Raymond and I on this. We were holding hymn books, little black books, turned to page 1. It was dark outside. On New Year's morning, we got up before sunrise. Daddy was looking at us with his chin pointed out. It meant to be still and sit straight. Raymond sat as straight and stiff as a soldier, waiting for Daddy to notice how nice and stiff he sat. We began singing. Page 1, Hymn for the New Year, Philip Nicolai, 1599. We didn't really need the books. We'd sung the same song every New Year since the time of our conception. Daddy always sang the loudest. The morning star upon us gleams, etc. How full of grace and truth his beams, how passing fair his splendor. Good shepherd, David's proper heir, my king in heaven thou dost me bear upon thy bosom tender. Nearest, dearest, highest, brightest, thou delightest still to love me, thou so high enthroned above me. I didn't mind, actually, singing hymns on New Year's, as long as I was sure no one else would find out. I'd have been rather embarrassed if any of my friends ever found out how we spent New Year's. It's easy at a certain age to be embarrassed about your family. I remember Alice Olson, how embarrassed she was about her father, Elmer Olson. He was an alcoholic and couldn't control his urine. Her mother always had to clean up after him. Even so, the house smelled. I suppose she couldn't get it all. Anyway, I knew Alice was embarrassed when we saw Elmer all tousled and sick-looking with urine stains on his trousers. Actually, I don't know what would be harder on a kid, having a father who was drunk or one who's sober on New Year's and sings the Morning Star. I walked across the deck and handed Jesus the wine. I sat down, resting my glass on the flap of my kimono. Jesus was looking out over the prairie. He seemed to be noticing everything out there. He was obviously in no hurry to leave, but he didn't have much to say. I thought of what to say next. I suppose you're more used to the sea than to the prairie. Yes, he answered, I've lived most of my life near water, but I like the prairie too. There's something nice about the prairie. He turned his face to the wind, stronger now, coming toward us from the east. Nice again. If I'd ever used that word to describe the prairie in an English theme at St. John's, for example, it would have had 3 red circles around it, at least 3. I raised my glass to the wind. Good old St. John's. Good old Pastor Solberg standing in front of the wooden altar, holding the gospel aloft in his hands. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. All things were made by him, and without him was not anything made that was made. I was sitting on a bench by a Paul Thorsen. We were sharing a hymnal. Our thumbs touched at the center of the book. It was winter. The chapel was cold, an army barracks left over from World War II. We wore parkas and sat close together. Paul fooled around with his thumb, pushing my thumb to my own side of the book, then pulling it back to his side. The wind howled outside. We watched our breath and we sang the hymn. In thine arms I rest me, foes who would molest me cannot reach me here. Though the earth be shaking, every heart be quaking, Jesus, calm my fear. Fires may flash and thunder crash, yea, and sin and hell as assail me, Jesus will not fail me. And here he was, Alpha and Omega, the Word, sitting on my canvas chair, telling me the prayer is nice. What could I say to that? I like it too, I said. Jesus was watching a magpie circling above the poplars just beyond the quarry. He seemed very nice, actually. But he wasn't like my father. My father was perfect, mind you, but you know about perfect people. Busy, busy. He wasn't as busy as Elsie, though. Elsie was the busy one. You could never visit there without her having to do something else at the same time. Wash the leaves of her plant with milk or fold socks in the basement while you sat on a bench by the washing machine. I wouldn't mind sitting on a bench in the basement if that was all she had, but her living room was full of big, soft chairs that no one ever sat in. Now, Christ here didn't seem to have any work to do at all. The wind had risen now. His robes puffed about his legs, his hair swirled around his face. I set my glass down and held my kimono together at my knees. The wind was coming stronger now, out of the east. My kimono flapped about my ankles. I bent down to secure the bottom, pressing the moving cloth close against my legs. A Saskatchewan wind comes up in a hurry, let me tell you. Then it happened. A gust of wind hit me straight on, seeping into the folds of my kimono, reaching down into the bodice, billowing the cloth out, until above the sash the robe was fully open. I knew without looking. The wind was suddenly blowing on my breasts. It felt cool on both my breasts. Then, as quickly as it came, it left, and we sat in the small breeze of before. I looked at Jesus. He was looking at me and at my breasts, looking right at them. Jesus was sitting there on the sun deck looking at my breasts. What should I do? Say excuse me and push them back into the kimono? Make a little joke of it? Look what the wind blew in or something? Or should I say nothing, just tuck them in as inconspicuously as possible? What do you say when a wind comes up and blows your kimono open and he sees your breasts? Now there are ways and there are ways of exposing your breasts. I know a few things. I read books. And I've learned a lot from my cousin Millie. Millie's the black sheep of the family. She left the academy without graduating to become an artist's model in Winnipeg, a dancer, too. Anyway, Millie's told me a few things about body exposure. She says, for instance, that when an artist wants to draw his model, he has her either completely nude and stretching and bending in various positions so he can sketch her from different angles, or he drapes her with cloth, satin usually. He covers one section of the body with the material and leaves the rest exposed, but he does so in a graceful manner, draping the cloth over her stomach or ankle, never over the breasts. So I realized that my appearance right then wasn't actually pleasing, either aesthetically or erotically, from Millie's point of view. My breasts were just sticking out from the top of my old kimono. And for some reason that I certainly can't explain, even to this day, I did nothing about it. I just sat there. Jesus must have recognized my confusion because right then he said, quite sincerely, I thought, "You have nice breasts." "Thanks," I said. I didn't know what else to say, so I asked him if he'd like more wine. "Yes, I would," he said, and I left to refill the glass. When I returned, he was watching the magpie swishing about in the tall weeds of the quarry. I sat down and watched with him. Then I got a very, very peculiar sensation. I knew it was just an illusion, but it was so strong it scared me. It's hard to explain because nothing like it had ever happened to me before. The magpie began to float toward Jesus. I saw it fluttering toward him in the air as if some vacuum were sucking it in. When it reached him, it flapped about on his chest, which was bare now because the top of his robe had slipped down. It nibbled at his little brown nipples and squawked and disappeared. For all the world, it seemed to disappear right into his pores. Then the same thing happened with a rock. A rock floated up from the quarry and landed on the breast of Jesus, melting into his skin. It was very strange, let me tell you, Jesus and I sitting there together with that happening. It made me dizzy, so I closed my eyes. I saw the women in a public bath in Tokyo, black-haired women and children. Some were squatting by faucets that lined a wall. They were running hot water into their basins, washing themselves with white cloths, rubbing each other's backs with the soapy washcloths, and then emptying their basins and filling them again, pouring clean water over their bodies for the rinse. Water and suds swirled about on the tiled floor. Others were sitting in the hot pool on the far side, soaking themselves in the steamy water as they jabbered away to one another. Then I saw her, the woman without breasts. She was squatting by a faucet near the door. The oldest woman I've ever seen, the thinnest woman I've ever witnessed, skin and bones, literally, just skin and bones. She bowed and smiled at everyone who entered. She had three teeth. When she hunched over her basin, I saw the little creases of skin where her breasts had been. When she stood up, the wrinkles disappeared. In their place were two shallow caves. Even the nipples seemed to have disappeared into the small brown caves of her breasts. I opened my eyes and looked at Jesus. Fortunately, everything had stopped floating. "Have you ever been to Japan?" I asked. "Yes," he said, "a few times." I paid no attention to his answer, but went on telling him about Japan as if he'd never been there. I couldn't seem to stop talking about that old woman and her breasts. "You should have seen her," I said. "She wasn't flat-chested like some women even here in Moose Jaw. It wasn't like that at all. Her breasts weren't just flat, they were caved in, as if the flesh had sunk right there. Have you ever seen breasts like that before?" Jesus' eyes were getting darker. He seemed to have sunk further down into his chair. "Japanese women have smaller breasts to begin with, usually," he said. But he'd misunderstood me. It wasn't just her breasts that held me, it was her jaws, teeth, neck, ankles, heels, not just her breasts. I said nothing for a while. Jesus, too, was not talking. Finally, I asked, "Well, what do you think of breasts like that?" I knew immediately that I'd asked the wrong question. If you want personal and specific answers, you ask personal and specific questions. It's as simple as that. I should have asked him, for instance, what he thought of them from a sexual point of view. If he were a lover, let's say, would he like to hold such breasts in his hands and play on them with his teeth and fingers? Would he now? The woman, brown and shiny, was bending over her basin. Tiny bubbles of soap drifted from the creases of her chest down to her navel. Hold them, ha! Or I could have asked for some kind of aesthetic opinion. If he were an artist, a sculptor, let's say, would he travel to Italy and spend weeks excavating the best marble from the hills near Florence? And then would he stay up night and day in his studio without eating or bathing, and with matted hair and glazed eyes, chisel out the little creases from his great stone slab? Or if he were a curator in a large museum in Paris, would he place those wrinkles on a silver pedestal in the center of the foyer? Or if he were a patron of the arts, would he attend the opening of this grand exhibition and stand in front of these white caves in his purple turtleneck, sipping champagne and nibbling on the little cracker with a shrimp in the middle? And would he turn to the one beside him, the one in the sleek black pants, and would he say to her, "Look, darling, did you see this marvelous piece? Did you see how the artist has captured the very essence of the female form?" These are some of the things I could have said if I'd had my wits about me, but my wits certainly left me that day. All I did say, and I didn't mean it, it just came out, was, "It's not nice, and I don't like it." I lifted my face, threw my head back, and let the wind blow on my neck and breasts. It was blowing harder again. I felt small grains of sand scrape against my skin. Almost like Jimmy that time in Prince Albert. Jimmy's an old neighbor from Regina. On his 27th birthday, he joined a motorcycle gang, the Grim Reapers to be exact, and got into a lot of trouble. He ended up in maximum security. One summer on a camping trip up north, we stopped to see him, Fred and I and the kids. It wasn't a good visit, by the way. If you're going to visit inmates, you should do it regularly. I realize this now. Anyway, that's when his eyes looked black like that. But maybe he'd been smoking. It's probably not the same thing. Jimmy LeBrun. He never did think it was funny when I'd call him a Midnight Raider instead of a Grim Reaper. People are sensitive about their names. Then Jesus finally answered. Everything seemed to take him a long time, even answering simple questions. But I'm not sure what he said, because something so strange happened that whatever he did say was swept away. Right then, the wind blew against my face, pulling my hair back. My kimono swirled about every which way, and I was swinging my arms in the air like swimming. And there, right below my eyes, was the roof of our house. I was looking down on the top of the roof. I saw the row of shingles ripped loose from the August hailstorm, and I remember thinking, Fred hasn't fixed those shingles yet. I'll have to remind him when he gets home from work. If it rains again, the back bedroom will get soaked. Before I knew it, I was circling over the sun deck, looking down on the top of Jesus' head. Only I wasn't. I was sitting in the canvas chair, watching myself hover over his shoulders. Only it wasn't me hovering, it was the old woman in Tokyo. I saw her gray hair twisting in the wind and her shiny little bum raised in the air like a baby's. Water was dripping from her chin and toes, and soap bubbles trailed from her elbows like tinsel. She was floating down towards his chest. Only it wasn't her, it was me. I could taste bits of sud sticking to the corner of my mouth and feel the wind on my wet back and in the hollow caves of my breasts. I was smiling and bowing, and the wind was blowing in narrow wisps against my toothless gums. Then quickly, so quickly, like a flock of winter sparrows diving through snow into the branches of the poplar, I was splitting up into millions and millions of pieces and sinking into the tiny, tiny holes in his chest. It was like the magpie in the rock, like I had come apart into atoms or molecules or whatever it is we really are. After that, I was dizzy. I began to feel nauseated. There on my canvas chair, Jesus looked sick too, sad and sick and lonesome. Oh Christ, I thought, why are we sitting here on such a fine day, pouring our sorrows into each other? I had to get up and walk around. I'd go into the kitchen and make some tea. I put the kettle on to boil. What on earth had gotten into me? Why had I spent this perfectly good morning talking about breasts? My once chance in a lifetime, and I'd let it go. Why didn't I have better control? Why was I always letting things get out of hand? Breasts! And why was my name Gloria? Such a pious name for one who can't think of anything else to talk about but breasts. Why wasn't it Lucille or Millie? You could talk about breasts all day if your name was Millie. But Gloria, Gloria, Gloria. Then I knew why so many Glorias hang around bars talking too loud, laughing shrilly at stupid jokes, making sure everyone hears them laugh at the dirty jokes. They're just trying to live down their name, that's all. I brought out the cups and poured the tea. Everything was back to normal when I returned, except that Jesus still looked desolate sitting there in my canvas chair. I handed him the tea and sat down beside him. Oh, Daddy, and Philip Nikolai, O Bernard of Clairvaux, O Sacred Head now wounded, go away for a little while and let us sit together quietly here in this small space under the sun. I sipped the tea and watched his face. He looked so sorrowful, I reached out and put my hand on his wrist. I sat there a long while, rubbing the little hairs on his wrist with my fingers. I couldn't help it. After that, he put his arm on my shoulder and his hand on the back of my neck, stroking the muscles there. It felt good. Whenever anything exciting or unusual happens to me, my neck is the first to feel it. It gets stiff and knotted up. Then I usually get a headache, and frequently I become nauseous. So it felt very good to have my neck rubbed. I've never been able to handle sensations very well. I remember when I was in grade 3 and my folks took us to the Saskatoon exhibition. We went to see the grandstand show, the Battle of Wolfe and Montcalm on the Plains of Abraham. The stage was filled with Indians and pioneers and ladies in red, white, and blue dresses singing In Days of Yore from Britain's Shore. It was very spectacular, but too much for me. My stomach was upset and my neck ached. I had to keep my head on my mother's lap the whole time, just opening my eyes once in a while so I wouldn't miss everything. So it felt really good having my neck stroked like that. I could almost feel the knots untying and my body becoming warmer and more restful. Jesus seemed to be feeling better. His body was back to normal. His eyes looked natural again. Then, all of a sudden, he started to laugh. He held his hand on my neck and laughed out loud. I don't know to this day what he was laughing about. There was nothing funny there at all. But hearing him laugh made me laugh, too. I couldn't stop. He was laughing so hard he spilled the tea over his purple stole. When I saw that, I laughed even harder. I never thought of Jesus spilling his tea before. And when Jesus saw me laugh so hard, and when he looked at my breasts shaking, he laughed harder still, till he wiped tears from his eyes. After that, we just sat there. I don't know how long. I know we watched the magpie carve black waves in the air above the rocks, and the rocks stiff and lovely among the swaying reeds. We watched the poplars twist and bend and rise again beyond the quarry. And then he had to leave. Goodbye, Gloria Johnson, he said, rising from his chair. Thanks for the hospitality. He leaned over and kissed me on my mouth. Then he flicked my nipple with his finger. Off he went, down the hill, through the quarry, and into the prairie. I stood on the sun deck and watched. I watched until I could see him no longer. Until he was only something dim, he was only some dim and ancient star on the far horizon. I went inside the house. Well now, wasn't that a nice visit? Wasn't that something? I examined the clothes, dry and sour, in the living room. I'd have to put them back in the wash, that's all. I couldn't stand the smell. I tucked my breasts back into my kimono and lugged the basket downstairs. That's what happened to me in Moose Jaw in 1972. It was the main thing that happened to me that year. Well... I should say that Gloria Sawai is the daughter of a Lutheran minister, the woman who wrote the story. I don't know why I should say that. How does it make you feel? How do you feel about that?
Well, it's weird. It seems like waking dreams or something.
Yeah.
What quantity of wine she had consumed.
You wonder about the wine, yeah.
Yes.
Either whether, I mean, on the literal level, she'd had too much wine or she fell asleep and dreamed. You know, that's sort of what's given to you in the frame as a way of dealing with it literally. Mm-hmm. But,
It's the obsession with breasts, I don't understand.
Uh-huh. And you notice that Jesus ends up bare, too. And his breast becomes a place where people go, or where rocks and birds and people go. And this one hymn that she quotes, the first two lines of, Jesus, lover of my soul, let me to thy bosom fly, while the nearer waters roll, while the tempest still is nigh. In the nearer waters, they'd already set up a kind of parallel between the prairie and the sea. So the prairie was like the sea. And those of you who, I was raised in Moorhead, Minnesota, and to me the prairie being like the sea is a very natural kind of a connection. While the tempest just still is nigh, the tempest I would associate with wind, and that, you know, these two mighty winds came into them during their time there. So Jesus, lover of my soul, let me to thy bosom fly while the nearer waters roll, while the tempest still is nigh, is a hymn that it sort of hangs on to some extent. There's something that reflects in there that's, it's a mirror to the story, I think. It's a good one. Do you want to dismiss it because of the, are you tempted to dismiss it and say, well, it's just a dream, or it's just a drunken fantasy?
Everything sounds like drunken fantasy. It sounds as though alcohol plays a real key point in her life, not so much out of fantasy, but the fact that she talks about, is it worse to have someone who's sober and gives a speech as opposed to the person who drinks all the time and wets his pants? So I think that's much more than whether she's actually drinking or not. I think it has a real corollary in what's going on in her life.
Interesting point, yeah.
And that the Jesus sitting on her sun deck wasn't the remote one who, you know, who was sober on New Year's Day or whatever. He was the one who would, sit there in the morning in the sunshine and sip wine after.
Yeah, it's interesting too. He was very real in lots of ways. The alcohol is one of the things to think about, the role of alcohol in this thing, because she was presented as such a perfectly normal person in the frame until she took that bottle of wine out, and that kind of, you know, threw things into a little odd frame. I mean, she was going to iron. You know, and her kids had gone off to school.
I really kind of like the way that she mixed in the sort of mystical with the ordinary. I like that a lot. And I guess what I thought about when she was sitting there with Jesus and both and their breasts were both exposed, it made me think about if. Like Jesus as a woman, if Jesus had been a woman there, it would have been no big deal. It would have been pretty comfortable, and apparently it was pretty comfortable because she sat there and she just didn't cover herself up. So there was that feeling of comfortableness and acceptance and kind of humanness.
And she actually refers to Jesus being like her mother at one point. That I can find the place right away. She does say right when he's come, he wasn't a bit like my father. Because my father was perfect. You know what she means about someone who can't sit and just be when you have company, but someone who has to be darning or sorting or cleaning the leaves of the philodendron with milk. I mean, we all have a little of that in us, don't we?
But she's also defined as perfect person as Jesus, too, in that it's all in her mind of what Jesus was like, since she had seen these pictures, and he represented everything she'd ever seen in a picture. And if one were talking about what Jesus represents, is it what you have seen? Is there other references when you talk biblically? It's not what you have seen, it's what you haven't seen. But for her, it's what she has seen through the ages, all of these pictures, and this is the perfect being.
Well, let's look at that a little more. It's certainly one of the things going on in the story is a contrast between what she's been taught about religion, about who Jesus is, about who God is, what religion is, who she is vis-a-vis the Almighty, or all these hymns that keep coming back to her, and all of her images of church and religion and correct behavior through that funnel, and then the reality of this experience that she's having. I mean, that's where a lot of the shine comes onto the story, is because of the contrast of these two things. What's there for you in that? What are some of the contrasts, or are they in contrast? Are there some things that are the same about her inherited sense of religiousness from her father, whom she describes as a religious man? Which is why I lived in the dormitory then, because of my father. He was a religious man and wanted me to get spiritual education, to hear the Word in capital letters and know the Lord in capital letters, as he put it. So he sent me to St. John's Lutheran Academy in Regina for 2 years. He was confident, I guess, that's where I'd hear the Word in capital letters. So there are many references to what the Word is in here. I mean, there are all these hymns, and then there are some notions about religiousness and about who Jesus is. So what is there anything there for you?
Yeah, I guess it's Jesus came in an ordinary place in the morning. You know, very ordinary, again, mixing the mystical and the ordinary, and not in the confines of a Lutheran, whatever it was.
And so identifiable, just as she would expect him to be.
He looked exactly,
you know, that there was no question to her. This is who it was.
And also the fact that that as she was with him, she was transported to Japan, just felt a part of other people who were in much sadder shape than she was. And also thinking of somebody in prison, and this her conscience playing a part in that too, identifying with other people as she saw him.
Very interesting, very interesting. So she really did, didn't she, take on the humanity of some others? Including the, we'll have to eventually decide about those breasts and what the depletedness or the hollowness of that old thin woman's breasts meant, or how it works in the story. But yeah, and the lessons she learned about her friend who was in prison.
I was impressed by the sexuality expressed. Maybe it's because I'm a daughter of a Lutheran pastor too. But there was definitely a concern there in whether it, you know, ties in with the alcoholism as far as an underlying something that she'd been taught, you know. But it's just the openness of the physical Jesus and this woman on her sun deck is very interesting too. I don't know what it says or what it indicates, but there is definitely a freedom that was given to her about the touching one another.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, on some level you would want that to be true about Jesus, wouldn't you? Mm-hmm. Just as I am without one plea, you know, I'm sort of, we ought to be comfortable with our bodies, to be naked before Jesus, because God is God and made us. And I mean, it's like a child and a parent or something. You want to feel like the nakedness is not a problem with a child and a parent. And if God is our creator, he made us as we are. You know, I mean, this is all she wrote. This is how I look, God. You made me, and this is what I am. So there's something appropriate about that. And then Jesus sort of bearing himself in front of her, and reciprocal. I mean, there's a lot of reciprocal stuff that went on here. It, you know, it just happened that his chest happened to be bare too, you know. It's one of the things that feminists always notice about pornography. When you look at pornography in classes, the first lesson is that in American advertising, the women are naked or undressed and the men are dressed. You know, it's men in suits and women in bathing suits and stuff like that. And here, just sort of nicely, that didn't happen.
Mm-hmm. On the other hand, in terms of contrasts, he looked exactly like she expected him to look. But he didn't behave or particularly do what she somehow seemed to imply that she had some expectations about. I mean, just the fact that he sat down and seemed to not be what she expected him to do.
But she seemed to be surprised that he looked that way. She goes on and on about it and says, and he looked just like all the pictures. I don't see how they got it right. And it seems like she didn't expect him to look just like the pictures. She was free for a little bit of a difference there, but lo and behold, there he was. Like, maybe there was a little surprise in that part, too.
I took that very tongue-in-cheek. I took that from exactly the opposite point of view. That was a kind of a really exaggerated kind of tongue-in-cheek. That's so stupid. I mean, for one thing, artists don't necessarily depict him identically. I mean, how could that be?
Now, tell me the truth. If Jesus came walking through that door right now, looking like all those pictures since you were a baby, would you recognize him?
I think I have a problem with that, too, because it just makes me think about where Jesus talks about the Good Samaritan, and he says, if the Good Samaritan came to your door, would you recognize him? And it's not because you would physically recognize him. Would you recognize the act? And at the point that she's explaining this, she's not talking about the act. She's got this picture fixed in her mind, 1,000 pictures she's seen. And, you know, it makes me question her concept of what Jesus means to her. Not because I agree or disagree, just merely her concept when she relates this in so many unusual ways, if you will, from exposure on. And even her terms with exposure is kind of obscure in a way, since she refers to it exposure. I think if we were talking in reference to whether Jesus or not saw me with my breasts out, it would be immaterial. Jesus knows all and sees all and understands all from the way that I was raised, so therefore it's not a question of is it acceptable or unacceptable. Even in my worldly being, to cope with it that way, I don't think that that would be a reaction that I would place there. But on the other hand, I think I would relate very strongly to, if Jesus walked in the door in this room right now, what would my reaction be?
And certainly one of the tensions in this story is that we are told, even if, as you have done it unto the least of these, my brethren, you've done it unto me, and things like that, the Good Samaritan, you know, that Jesus is among us, you know. And so it's not surprising that Jesus would show up on our deck one day, because that's one of the places where we are. I mean, there's nothing direct here, but there's... I thought of that as I was reading the story.
In some ways, some of her experience seems so superficial and so unreal that it makes me wonder, you know. But then, in order to put this thing together, she must be some kind of thinker, this person, you know.
Right, and she's every so often just hit with all the big fancy words about Jesus, wonderful counselor, mighty God, you know, Prince of Peace, and he's on my deck, and I can ask him anything I want. I can't think of anything to him. he will know the answer. He knows the answer, but I can't think of a way to ask, or I can't, you know. So she is. I think the narrator deliberately brings us back down to this being a very common person. And I think the reason for that is so that we can all feel some connection with this person. This is a real, ordinary person. This is not someone that I couldn't be, or this person doesn't have some thoughts and feelings that I couldn't have.
And yet the magpie comes and absorbs in his chest. What else was something?
A rock.
And she herself.
And then she has that out-of-body experience, and then she enters the body of a Japanese woman and becomes that woman for a while. Both of which are kind of spooky experiences.
So there's mysticism along with realism.
And during those two experiences is when Jesus' eyes get very dark and he gets small and sad and you know, bad. Or a bad feeling about it.
There's a couple of threads going through my mind. Why was she sent to the academy? To hear the word and to know Jesus. And think, I'm wondering how much of the Old Testament concept know the sexual implications to know Jesus was involved. And the other thing is that the thing that Jesus manipulates her into doing, giving her the glass of wine, or giving him the glass of wine, would be the most unexpected thing, because assuming a pietistic background, Jesus simply wouldn't drink wine except at Holy Communion.
Let's see.
No way.
I mean, I kept waiting for bread to appear too. Because the bread and the wine. And then all the references to the wind and the key thing that the wind played, and the wind and the Holy Spirit, you know. And so there was wine, if not bread, and wind, Holy Spirit, that really both of those things came in at real key times throughout. Mm-hmm. But the Holy Spirit was really blowing around when Jesus got dark eyes and far away. But that was when she identified him with that prisoner who was miserable.
I was curious about, same as this gentleman, which he talked about her going away to the university. I was curious about what she understood as, quote unquote, the word. You mentioned several times it's in capital letters. And
she quotes the word,
yes,
a number of times throughout the story.
But I didn't grow up in a Lutheran background, but I can remember as a child my father often said to me, when we talked about religion, spirituality, he said, it is not enough to say you believe. And of course, I can remember the first time we had this conversation, because I used to read a lot of religious books. And I was very intrigued with them. And as I'm sure it was probably about 12 or 13 when we had this conversation, and he was not talking down to me, we just happened to be talking about it. And he said, it is not enough to simply believe, you have to fully accept that as a way of life. And oftentimes we pay lip service to our belief, but a belief is something that becomes ingrained in you, and your actions carry it out. Mm-hmm. And it sounds as though when she's talking about the word, it's almost as though there's a conflict between her understanding of the word and what does the word actually mean in her life. Just by the way that it's emphasized so many times, and her perceptions of other things that are going on. I mean, the picture of Jesus and what he looks like. I mean, if you've got a belief, and it is a true belief, it's not because there's a picture. It's not because you've seen the image, even. I think it would be most clear. And yet she's not terribly clear there. Out of her perception, she's not clear.
Mm-hmm. I would imagine that Jesus coming to anybody would be coming in the image that that person would have in their mind of Jesus.
But when you describe it, what I'm getting at, you would say Jesus may have come to me last night, but you could not tell me what Jesus looked like to you. Mm-hmm. You probably know within your heart
you what
that was.
Yeah.
Yes, that's why I'm saying I'm questioning her.
I have a thought just approaching this from a completely different, maybe kind of irreverent perspective, not knowing who the author is or what religious convictions or lack of them may be. But I said first, it sounded to me like sort of a dream with a lot of symbolism and so forth. And I feel like I need to know why she dreamed this dream or had this experience. It seemed, on the one hand, she could be relating to her own experience as a mother of five children and somehow wanting to validate that, and Jesus in this sequence validated her, I don't know, feminine worth, sexuality, vitality, and so forth. On the other hand, it seems like she could just be writing the story in a very playful fashion and maybe not having religious beliefs anymore at all, particularly. Mm-hmm. So I'm kind of puzzled.